I want to thank you, attorneys, for the extra steps you may have had to take to join us by WebEx. We appreciate that. So we're going to proceed just as we would if we were in the courtroom. You see the clock, so you can gauge your time. And we're allowed to go ahead and jump in with questions when we want, so be prepared for that. So we'll go ahead and get started. The first case this morning is Mogensen Brothers, Landon Cattle versus Steve Mogensen, and Steve Mogensen versus Keith Mogensen. And we'll go ahead and start with appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Keith, Brian, and Stephen Mogensen were equal partners in a Mogensen Brothers partnership since the 70s. During the last 6 years of the Mogensen Brother partnership, in which Keith Mogensen was in charge and was in fact the managing partner, 2007 to 2014, Keith and his family received a total of $1.3 million from the partnership in payments to them personally or into organizations they own. His brother, Brian, who lived and worked in Ohio in a business in which Keith had an interest, received $758,000. During that same period of time, my client, Steve Mogensen, received $15,000. Then a receiver was appointed in 2014 to 2018. Each brother during that period received from the receiver $400,000 from the operations of the partnership under the care of the receiver. When these cases were settled on the morning of the trial, when the trial was supposed to start, the partners agreed to equally divide the real estate and the equipment, and they also agreed to, quote, a final accounting of all partnership profits and expenses of the partnership up to the time the receiver was appointed and took over. Because Keith was in charge of the books and records, it was his obligation to come forward on the accounting. What Keith produced was only a general ledger, a QuickBooks general ledger since mid-2008, which our expert testified was inadequate as accounting. There were no underlying records, no bills of sale, no records that you would normally look for, no promissory notes or amortization scheduled on claimed loans. The accounting, which was agreed to as part of the settlement, was wholly inadequate by Keith. The court held that—
Mr. Houghton, let me stop you there. Would that have been a question of fact for the trial court?
Would what have been?
Whether the accounting was adequate.
Sure, absolutely. And I'm saying based on this record, it was wholly inadequate. And we asked the court to reverse that ruling. And you're reviewing this de novo on the record. So the next issue we'd like to talk about is the statute of limitations. In the recent case, Way versus Gotch, the Supreme Court affirmed the principle that accounting is due at the dissolution of the partnership. The district court did not have the benefit of the Way case when her opinion was issued in January of 2019.
Mr. Houghton. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
How far back are you suggesting the court be able to go?
2005.
Okay, so you agree that the settlement agreement and order that was entered in 2005 would bar any look back prior to that?
2005 is where we're looking.
So you're trying to fill that gap between 2005 and 2009 where the court was.
That's right. We believe that's the law, that the dissolution— accounting is due at the dissolution. In SA versus SA, it's a well-settled principle that a managing partner has a continuing duty to account. So we believe that that's the law. In addition, there was an agreement to allow the accounting. That was part of the settlement. And so there were no rights reserved to bring up the statute of limitations as an affirmative defense. We believe that was waived. And so we believe that we have that the statute of limitations ruling was in error for a number of different reasons, including the settlement and the fact that that's the law in the state.
Mr. Houghton,
please.
The Way case was a breach of contract case. How is that applicable to a dissolution of partnership case?
Well, we believe he breached. We believe he breached the contract, the partnership agreement, in several respects. The difference is they're identical in that both Way and in this case, the partner had fiduciary duties and they had a contract, the partnership agreement, and there was an obligation to account at the end of it.
The appellee indicates that they believe that 67425 and the comment to Section 405 of the Uniform Partnership Act apply here, and that would be the basis for the four-year statute of limitations. How do you analyze those sections as applicable here?
I don't have that section right in front of me, but the problem with the appellee's position in this case is that the statutes that they provided are default rules, and you can override those with the partnership agreement. In this case, the car partnership agreement controls.
Is it the partnership agreement that gives that right under the statute of limitations, or is it the settlement agreement?
It's both. They had an agreement. They made an agreement.
Could the settlement agreement change the statute of limitations?
Sure. Statute of limitations is a waivable defense. It's an affirmative defense that's waivable. And that's what happened. It was not preserved. Everything went away in the pleadings, and the settlement agreement became law of the case.
Did the settlement agreement it provided that an accounting be done? Is that correct?
It said that there will be an accounting of all partnership expenses and profits up to the time a receiver was appointed.
So, and I don't have the order right in front of me because I don't know how to figure out my screen. But there's some statement in the order where the judge makes the comment of, although they were entitled to an accounting, it doesn't necessarily mean that they were entitled to bring a claim on all of the actions that may have arisen, or something like that.
I don't recall that, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I don't recall that off the top of my head. Sorry. When looking at the general ledger, there are numerous instances of self-dealing. We've outlined those in our brief. The statute requires that a partner who self-deals holds all of the profits and all of the assets as trustee for the partnership. And once self-dealing is shown, that partner has the burden of proof to prove that no breach of fiduciary duty or the partnership agreement occurred, the standard of proof is clear and convincing evidence. When you look at this de novo record, you will find that there is no clear and convincing evidence on any of these issues. The court came up with several instances where she's requiring Keith to pay back to the partnership certain monies. But on the rest of them, I'm running out of time, so I can't go through all of them. But on the rest of them, we set out in our brief what the testimony was, and we point to that testimony. We suggest that it does not meet the burden of proof, let alone the clear and convincing. There was also a partnership opportunity and a 2013 loan for which Mr. Keith Mogensen admitted he didn't know where the $30,000 that he listed as miscellaneous expenses went. He couldn't tell us where that was. He also brought a claim against Stephen for his refusal to agree to participate in a USDA program. Stephen did his diligence. He went to the office at least four times, and he determined that the partnership did not qualify, and he thought it might be a crime, and somebody there told him he shouldn't sign. That refusal to sign is not a breach of his fiduciary duty. I would say it's fulfillment of his duty to his partners. Moreover, there was no testimony that if they had gotten it, or what amount they would have gotten. There is no testimony on that from any credible source.
Had they gotten it in the past?
I don't know. There was no evidence of that whatsoever in the record. We also would think that because of Way versus Gotch, the law is now clear that we get prejudgment interest. And again, the district court didn't have the benefit of that. I would like to keep the balance of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Moyer?
May it please the court. First thing I want to do is call the court's attention to an error in my cross appeal. At page 30, we quote paragraph 9 of the partnership agreement, and we say in the first sentence of that quotation, if any partner shall, with the written consent of the other partners, We put an S on the end of partners, and actually that's not in the contract. The contract says with the consent of the other partner, singular. And that changes the meaning of that, because then if you add more than two partners, you'd only need two partners to agree to a borrowing of money.
Mr. Moyer?
Yes.
Also on that same page of your brief, you quote some dates. I think it's in the second paragraph. And there's a December 20th date or December date. And the year is 5 digits instead of 4. You know what that correct date is supposed to be?
Oh, dear me. I didn't catch that. Is it? Which paragraph, Judge?
Leave second paragraph on page 30.
On page what, 30?
Page 30, right where you were.
Right where I was.
Say December, it's the third going into the fourth line, December 20th, 20016, 45,000. If you don't have it handy, that's fine. We can move on.
Thank you. Okay. I want to turn just briefly to the statute of limitations issue. Under the Uniform Partnership Act, as amended, the statute of limitations is to be drawn from other legislation. But it's clear in the comment that is mentioned by the court and by myself in my brief that the statute has been amended to require that issues between the partners be brought up during the existence of the partnership. Now, previously, the law was that you could bring up anything pertaining to the partnership in the final accounting of the partnership. But that's been changed by the amendments to the Partnership Act, and that is no longer the law. And the Partnership Act requires you to bring them up during the course of the partnership. Now, the district judge, in my opinion, just nailed that, because she went further than the comment to the Uniform Partnership Act, and she cited several of the cases that have been decided under the Partnership Act in places like Delaware and Massachusetts and Connecticut, in which they have held that you have to bring up these claimed breaches of the partnership agreement during the course of the partnership, or the statute of limitations will apply to them and they will be barred by the statute of limitations. Now he says,
How does the settlement agreement affect that when there's no mention of any affirmative defense of the statute of limitations?
Well, we agreed in the settlement agreement to a lot of things, but one of the things that we did agree was that at the termination of the partnership, the partners are entitled to an accounting, and we didn't object to that. But we also pleaded the statute of limitations, and we didn't waive that. We never said we were waiving anything that was in our pleadings. We just agreed that since the partnership was dissolved, that all the partners were entitled to an accounting.
But Mr. Boyer, the June 2017 agreement and order specifically addresses that the accounting shall encompass the period of time prior to the appointment of the receiver. And so it's not limited, right? I mean, it provided for that. And there was each individual was asked if they agreed with the terms as read by the judge, from what I can tell, and they agreed. And so if no limitation was put on in that agreement and in that order, hasn't it been waived, at least back to 2005, the prior order?
No, I don't agree with that. I think you'd have to specifically waive your defenses. Now, all we did was say that there would be an accounting, but we didn't specifically waive any defenses that had been pleaded, such as res judicata and such as the statute of limitations. And the court didn't specifically inquire of us if this was a waiver. And if she had, we'd have said, no, we're not waiving our defenses. We're just agreeing that since the partnership is dissolved, all the partners are entitled to an accounting. And that's the way I took it at that time. And I certainly never considered at all that we were waiving any defenses that we had, including the statute of limitations, which by that.
If we could, I'd like to just quickly get to your cross appeal issue with regard to the interest on Stephen's portion of the settlement share. Is your argument, it seems to me you're arguing that pursuant to another order, he was required to pay interest on that portion of the settlement share, that it's not a matter of prejudgment or post-judgment interest that appears to be argued by Stephen's attorney, is it? I'm just confused on what it is specifically you're requesting in your cross appeal with regard to Stephen's interest on his settlement share.
Well, I don't think we're talking about his settlement share. We're talking about the interest to the Cedar Rapids State Bank.
Yeah, and wasn't there a settlement agreement between the parties, though, that each would pay one third of what was owed?
Sure, and that included what was owed for interest, too.
Right. So is that what's at issue, is that in that agreement that each party would pay one third share, that would also include interest until court approval of the receiver's distribution?
Correct.
Okay. So that's not a matter of post-judgment interest or prejudgment.
No, post-judgment or prejudgment interest, it's a matter of the bank had charged interest on those loans. And Stephen was agreeing to pay one third of those loans, which should include the interest that was charged and paid by the other two partners on those loans.
And
that's
how much
what that refers to.
So did he not do that? Where can we find the amount that he paid and how it was short on the interest that was due?
Well, he didn't pay it. He hasn't paid it yet.
He hasn't paid any of it.
No. Okay. There's another lawsuit pending in the District Court of Boone County right now to compel him to pay it.
So is that an issue really in this appeal?
I think it is an issue in this appeal insofar as there should be some resolution of the fact that the payment to the Cedar Rapids State Bank by the other two partners included interest, about $15,000 on each loan. And that's omitted here from the court's decree. And we want to correct that error. Okay, can I proceed then?
Thank you.
For a minute.
Well, this is kind of new to me. You know, I just want to say one thing here about this argument that we have the duty to produce by clear and convincing evidence this accounting. First of all, this disparaged accounting system, according to the accountant who does our tax returns, is used by 80% of the farmers and businessmen in Northeast Nebraska. It's very commonly known to most lawyers and most accountants, and it will produce a tax return. I think one of the things that opposing counsel is overlooking is the fact that we had a receiver in this case, and the receiver was in control of this estate for 3.8 years, 3 years and 8 months. And during that time, there was a complete inventory of all the partnership property made. An appraisal of that property was completed, and there had been an auction of that property by the receiver to the partners, and they split up the partnership property by bidding on it. And it certainly wasn't necessary to go all the way back to that whole proceeding, which was, you know, before the court. Her records reflected the inventories and reflected the bidding and reflected what they got for each of the items. And so a lot of this was done by the partners themselves before we started this accounting. But then there's another thing here that plays
into this. Mr. Moyer, I just want to point out that you are out of time.
I'm out of time. Where did I put that on the screen anyway?
It should be on one of the blocks.
It's down here in the lower left-hand corner. Yeah, I see it now. Okay. I see it's
passing. If you have something,
I usually run out of time.
If you have something very brief that you want to wrap up with, that would be fine.
Well, I just want to wrap up with this. Stephen has never participated in this partnership. He has had at all times, according to the partnership agreement and the order of the district court in 2005, the right to look at the books and records of this partnership at any time. And he has never exercised that right. And they have put the burden on Stephen because Stephen stayed in the partnership and continued to develop the real estate and work the land. They have put this burden on him of clear and convincing evidence. And I don't think he's got a burden of clear and convincing evidence. That wouldn't be fair at all. Stephen's got to step in here and he's got to step into the harness and he's got to pull his weight. And he never did.
Thank you, Mr. Moyer. Mr. Houghton, how much time do we have left for Mr. Houghton?
1 minute and 15 seconds, Your Honor.
Mr. Houghton.
Oh, you're muted.
Let me just respond to a couple of things. In the circumstances of this case where Stephen did not have access to the books and records, he tried one time to get the books and records. He went to his mother's house. She called the sheriff. And so he did not try again after that. In these circumstances, the statute does not begin to run. There is a continuing duty by the managing partner to account. And that's been true continuously since 2005. The settlement agreement does in fact dissolve all the claims and defenses. That's true with any settlement agreement, unless they're specifically preserved. We preserved the accounting and Mr. Moyer preserved the right to claim that Stephen breached his fiduciary duty by not signing the USDA program documents. QuickBooks is in fact used by a lot of people for purposes of doing their tax returns. They're not an accounting mechanism. That is exactly right. What Mr. Moyer said is right, and that's exactly our point. It's used for taxing, for purposes of preparing tax records and tax forms. I see I'm out of time, and I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much for joining us in this manner, and the matter is submitted, so thank you.
Thank you too, Judge.
We'll just recess for about 10 minutes. And I think what I'm going to do is unmute and turn my video off, Judge Reedman and Judge Pirtle. I think we can do that and then just turn them back on at 9:30 when the next session starts.
And I'm not in the next session.
Oh, you're not. Yes. That's right. We're okay. Doing a lot of switching around of panels today, right? So thanks for joining us this morning.
All right. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You can't get out?
Well, if you run your cursor down at the bottom of the screen and big red X should show up.
Yeah, I'm.
If you click that, is it?
I can't. It won't. It's not responding. Well, there. It finally did. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you.